Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the shocking revelations uncovered by 60 Minutes that members of Congress enjoy a unique privilege exempting them from insider trading laws, which they have used to make millions in stock trades that would land an ordinary citizen or a Wall Street banker in jail. The Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy, Lisa Graves, joins us to explain this legalized larceny and whether the Stock Act that has languished in Congress could be revived by citizen outrage. Then we will discuss the mounting pressure from the Arab League and Jordan's King Abdullah on the Assad regime to step down and stop murdering the Syrian people. Bassam Haddad, the Director of the Middle East Studies Program at George Mason University, joins us to discuss whether the increasingly isolated Assad clan will respond to outside pressure, whether an armed rebellion is the only way to remove them. Then finally, we will talk about how the GOP became the party of the rich, the title of a special report in the latest edition of Rolling Stone by Tim Dickinson, who joins us to explain how the party of Lincoln became the party of the Koch brothers, and how Grover Norquist, the den mother of young conservative activists, who has been described as Liberace with a wife, became the most powerful lobbyist in Washington responsible for the greatest transfer of wealth in history from poor and middle-class Americans to the top 1%. Joining us now is Lisa Graves, the Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy. She's the publisher of PR Watch, Source Watch, Bankster USA, and ALEC-exposed.org. She previously served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government and as a leading strategist on civil rights advocacy and as a law professor at George Washington University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Graves.
Ian, thank you so much for having us on. I really appreciate it.
And I thought that I had reached a threshold of outrage about Washington, but watching the 60 Minutes piece on how the Congress is exempt or have exempted themselves from insider trading and how many, many Congress people, quite prominent ones, have taken advantage of this loophole, I must say I was just absolutely fuming. Well, how did you react to it?
I was shocked as well, Ian. We've been tracking corruption and the extraordinary influence of corporations on politicians, and then to see this story from 60 Minutes about how some politicians appear to be trading on special knowledge that they get to make a fortune, and that they have stopped efforts by Congressman Brian Baird and others to regulate that insider trading was really stunning. It was revelatory.
And, of course, Brian Baird is no longer in the Congress, which is probably why he spoke out. He has introduced the Stock Act in 2004, and which would make it illegal for members of Congress to trade stocks on non-public information and to report stock trades every 90 days instead of once a year. He managed to get Congresswoman Louise Slaughter on board, but he could only get six co-sponsors. So what does that tell you about the Congress?
Well, it's actually really stunning. Congressman Baird, it's a huge loss to the United States Congress that he has retired to spend more time with his family, because his Stock Act, I think, was a very good first step. And it wasn't even the type of bar that I would call for in terms of saying if you're a member sitting on a committee with jurisdiction over a particular industry, you shouldn't have any stocks in that industry at all. You shouldn't have any appearance of impropriety or conflict of interest at all. His measure was a very modest but important disclosure remedy to basically say if Congress people are trading in stocks, if their portfolios are changing, they have a duty to notify basically the public of that so the public can make their own decision. And it went nowhere. You're right, Congresswoman Slaughter of New York co-sponsored it along with a couple of others, but it fell on deaf ears in Congress, unfortunately.
Well, one of the more outrageous revelations, I thought, was Congressman Spencer Baucus, who bought stock options against a market fall on privileged information that he'd gotten from a crisis meeting when the financial crisis was unfolding in 2008, getting this information from Hank Paulson and Ben Bernanke, and then immediately going out and shorting the market, knowing what was going to tank, and making a ton of money. I mean, not only is that disgusting, it also feels like being a vulture. You're preying on a wounded country at a moment of crisis.
I agree with you. 60 Minutes was strained to say that they weren't suggesting that Mr. Bok is engaged in any crime, and that's in part because Congress has refused to regulate itself and make that sort of activity criminal. When I heard about the stock transactions of Congressman Baucus of Alabama, a longtime Republican member of the House, who actually profited by betting against the American, basically betting against the American economy, trying to make a gain from the failure on Wall Street, I was just sickened. And I think this demands a congressional investigation, a full investigation of his stock transactions. And I think actually, I think Congress should use this as an opportunity to clean its house and say that they will not tolerate the type of behavior that it appears that Congressman Bok is engaged in. I hope the people of Alabama are paying close attention to what Mr. Bok has did in betting against America and betting against the American economy with information that no other Americans outside of Congress, outside of the government, had at that time.
Again, I'm speaking with Lisa Graves, Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy, and we're talking about the 60 Minutes report that revealed that Congress has exempted itself from insider trading rules and that members of Congress routinely act on privileged information, non-public information, which they have access to since, of course, they make the laws. The House Majority Leader, Eric Cantor, he declined to say today whether or not he would support a law making it illegal for members of Congress. Do you think that, and he wasn't familiar with the details of the Stock Act, were, by the way, most of the congressmen that Steve Croft of 60 Minutes ambushed on their way down the steps of Capitol Hill, they also were unaware of it, and not surprisingly. Apparently, Cantor has been making killings off the recent economic hostage crisis that he and others generated. So not surprisingly, he is not rushing to reform. But apparently 60 Minutes are doing a piece on Cantor. Whether or not they'll reveal this stuff later, I don't know.
Well, it certainly is stomach-turning, and the fact is that Eric Cantor has a leadership role within the United States House. He is one step below Congressman Boehner, who was also implicated in the 60 Minutes story for his lucrative trading around health insurance stocks at the time that the health insurance reform was going through. The fact that the leaders of Congress aren't aware of efforts to basically reform their activity, I think, reveals a lot about how in essence, willfully ignorant some of these members are. But I actually think that it's quite probable that they're not as ignorant as they may say. The fact is that they know that there's not a bar on them trading stock. And, you know, I think that some of them apparently are using it to their full advantage. Some of these members come to Congress to be public servants or take a public servant salary, and meanwhile, as 60 Minutes documented, become millionaires while they're there, and then beyond that, once they get out of Congress.
Well, specifically, Eric Cantor apparently made lots of shady trades, including a short on U.S. Treasuries during the debt limit debate. So there you have, you know, Dracula in charge of the blood bank and draining the country's lifeblood.
No, I think that's right. I haven't seen the original piece on that, but what I've heard, Ian, is precisely as you say. It's a little bit like, as I've said about some of the activities I've seen in my time in Washington and beyond, it's a little bit like putting the termites in charge of the treehouse. It's not like letting the hen house, the fox guard the hen house. At the end of the day, you have a hen house. With some of these guys to be trading on their insider information against the country's interest to benefit their own financial bottom line, it really is destructive of the institution of Congress. It's destructive of our democratic process, and it basically suggests that there's no accountability and that these people, these members who've been elected, feel so emboldened that they don't think that they'll be held accountable. They must think their districts are awfully safe.
Well, of course, the point being, of course, it's not illegal for them to buy stock. Excuse me. It's not illegal for them to buy stocks and to engage in land deals. Now, Hastert was singled out for making land deals. I think the 60 Minutes actually confused a couple of things, because that wasn't a stock transaction. That was an earmark. And that is just totally common. I mean, we have a bunch of crooked congressmen out here in the Inland Empire that have been making land earmarks off freeways, where they get the special earmarks, and then they know where the freeway's going, so they buy up all of the land at the off ramps. That's quite common. There's a guy called Ken Calvert, former real estate guy out at Riverside, a Republican, who's made a career out of making money out of earmarks. He's still in the real estate business. It's absolutely amazing that this stuff goes on. So you mentioned there might be some outrage at the district level with Spencer Backus down in Alabama. What are you basing that optimism on?
No, I suppose I'm just hoping that people are paying attention, because I think that the fact is that it's not illegal, but that doesn't mean it's not corrupt. And this sort of activity certainly bespeaks a form of corruption that should be weeded out. People should be held accountable. I hope that Congressman Backus gets a lot of questions from his constituents about what he was doing with betting basically against the American economy and trying to take advantage of the fall, the crash in our economy, apparently, in the fall of 2008. I unfortunately, with respect to Mr. Backus and even Mr. Hastert, the former Speaker of the House from Illinois, who profited big from those earmarks on highway funds, basically the earmarks to build a highway across Illinois to the tune of, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars was the actual earmark. His profit for himself, I think, has not fully been outlined, but it is a form of corruption, and I think that the American people are waking up to how much corruption has been going on in Washington. But I don't know, given the way things have been districted and how the redistricting rules have been done in terms of how safe districts are, whether any of these politicians will pay any price at the ballot box for their conduct. Or their misconduct, really.
Well, Lisa Graves, the two big names that were in the CBS report on how insider trading is legal for people in the Congress were Nancy Pelosi and John Boehner. Boehner, of course, denies it and said that the trades were made by his business manager, and he had no knowledge of it. And also, Pelosi's come out with a very strenuous denial and citing the author of the report, of the book that 60 Minutes had based some of their reporting on, Peter Schweitzer at the Hoover Institution, who's the editor of BigPiece.com, which is a website founded by the conservative activist Andrew Breitbart. I guess that's, you know, attacking the messenger there. We'll see whether or not the information pans out. But why is it that the executive branch people have to put their holdings into blind trust? Why not the Congress? Because they have access to privileged information.
Well, I think you're right. I think that there's no excuse, really, for not having better rules for Congress. They should have blind trust. They shouldn't know what's in their stock portfolio. It should be blind. They should be blind to whether they profit or loss. In the case of Mr. Boehner, he has said that his financial advisor apparently made some especially well-timed investments related to health care, right, as the health care debate and resolution, in essence, the compromise that allowed the changes to go through, were going through. It seems mighty coincidental to me, but I suppose he's made his statement, and if anyone ever investigates, they may get to the bottom of what the truth is. But even knowing that you have financial advisors who may be looking out for different bills before Congress and in terms of trying to have a congressman benefit from them, I think it's unseemly. I think it creates an appearance of conflict of interest. I think it creates an appearance of corruption. And I think that in some instances, it may actually demonstrate actual corruption. I don't think these members ought to have stock portfolios or investment funds where they know what the stocks are. in terms of the corporations or industries that they're investing in. I think that it's just too close, given the inside information they have, for them to have those sort of investments. It means that they could stand to profit from the very decisions they've been put in Congress to decide as representatives for us, the American people, not as representatives for the corporations and not as representatives for their own personal profits.
Well, I guess we'll see how these congressmen, particularly Nancy Pelosi and Boehner, defend themselves, and Cantor, too, who wasn't even touched by that report, even though apparently he's pretty active in insider trading and recently went to Wall Street and promised all of the speculators that if the Republicans got elected, they'd take all the restrictions off. And we know that what restrictions they have are pretty weak at this moment, since they were, the price of oil, the price of food has been gamed outrageously in the last couple of years. So just in closing, what Lisa Gray's just in the last few seconds here, do you think that we are in fact going to see some movement on the Stock Act? Or how do people make that happen?
Well, I think that there may very well be outcry in response to 60 Minutes investigation, and that there will likely be calls on Congress to pass that act. Whether that House will pass it remains to be seen, but I think that it's one more fact, one more set of facts that demonstrates what many people believe about Washington being broken. And so I suspect that there may very well be pressure to pass that Stock Act. I hope that there's pressure to go further than that and bar them from holding stocks, not just reporting on the stocks that they hold.
I thank you for joining us, Lisa Graves.
Thank you so much, Ian.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Lisa Graves, who's the Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy. She's the publisher of PR Watch, Source Watch, Bankster USA, and ALEC Exposed. She previously served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as a leading strategist on civil liberties advocacy, and as a law professor at George Washington University. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll get an update on Syria. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bassam Haddad, who is the director of the Middle East Studies program at George Mason University and a visiting professor at Georgetown University. He serves as founding editor of the Arab Studies Journal. And his latest book on Syrian political economy is The Political Economy of Regime Security, State Business Networks in Syria. He also serves on the editorial committee of Middle East Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bassam Haddad.
Thank you for having me.
And clearly, the Assad clan are increasingly isolated in the Arab world, with the Arab League calling for Syria's ejection. Then King Abdullah of Jordan, speaking to the BBC, says if Bashar has the interest of his country at heart, he would step down, but he would also create an ability to reach out and start a new phase of Syrian political life. What is your reaction? Is this likely to have any effect?
I'm not sure if King Abdullah is actually the person to talk about reform, and that's why these words are not really going to matter very much, given what is happening or what has been happening in his own country. I would focus more on the situation in Syria, inside Syria, which has become unbearable as the death toll has reached 4,000 dead. It is basically an issue of regime brutality crushing the protesters. And that is the larger picture, which is not to be mistaken, because of the evidence that we have from the first day where the protesters were not violent, and yet they were also, you know, shot down and crushed. However, it is also important to recognize that the battle has changed and that now we have armed personnel within the opposition, and we have army defectors who have actually joined the opposition and now are fighting with using weapons. So now the situation is becoming more unclear, although we should not lose sight of the structural problem, which is the regime crushing of the protesters. That does not mean that we absolve the regime, definitely. It does mean, however, that the course of events are no longer as, you know, black and white as they were earlier. And it is important to recognize that while condemning the regime is the first priority of anyone with conscience, it is also important to be mindful of the problematic escalation of this conflict to the point where external intervention becomes an option, a real option. That will actually benefit no one in this situation, not least the Syrian people. So I feel that it's more important to have a clear view of what the opposition wants. It's also more important for the opposition itself to become far more organized and far less disjointed and get over their quibbles that have actually been rather embarrassing in the past couple of weeks, and mount a serious effort, collective effort, to stick to the basic demands. Instead, much of the opposition is in disarray about questions that would have to be dealt with after the transition or the fall of the regime. So it's a very complex situation. And anyone who basically presents it as a very straightforward situation of regime against protesters, as if it's actually just a local issue and just an issue of violence against unarmed opposition, it's actually not. It's more complex than that, with the caveat that no scenario and no narrative should absolve the regime's violence.
Well, there was a very compelling piece on Frontline recently where a courageous young woman snuck inside Syria and was able to film the opposition. And it was chilling how oppressive that regime is. I mean, if you're a supporter, if you're on the government payroll, if you go out and demonstrate on behalf of the Assads, or if you're an Alawite, a part of the insider clan, that's one thing. But to be on the wrong side of that regime is scary beyond belief. I'd be surprised if the opposition could do anything under those conditions, and I'm continually astounded at the enormous courage of the Syrian people to stand up against snipers and tank fire. I mean, you wouldn't find anybody over here doing that, I can guarantee you.
No, I mean, you wouldn't find that in a normal situation, even in Syria. Keep in mind that there was not some sort of some sort of a pill that everybody has been taking for 30 some years, and then all of a sudden they stopped taking it, and now they woke up to the reality of oppression, political oppression, economic deterioration, and lack of avenues for redress to struggle for the rights. It's basically a situation that has been getting worse over the years and gotten to the point where people were willing to actually do this, because at some point, this act is completely irrational, because you know that others will not join you because of the level of, let's say, destitution or hopelessness or desperation has not reached a certain point. But now it has, and that's why you see people just like in Tunisia and Egypt not concerned about doing this and actually doing that. Look at the Occupy Wall Street movement. You know, people don't feel that it's rational to begin doing certain things at this point, because they know that they will not be, you know, followed by other protesters, besides the fact that the situation is completely different. What I'm trying to say is that even a year ago, when the situation was not that structurally different, people were not doing what they are doing today. It's been triggered by Tunisia, and that trigger created a collective consciousness that allowed people to feel that now, if they actually do so, they will be followed by others, and they will not just be alone, because over the years and the decades, people have protested, and people have gone against the regime, and they actually suffered a horrible fate. And they alone suffered a horrible fate. That's why these numbers, these people were few. I don't want to say far in between, because people continued to protest over the years nonstop, but there were few of them.
And now there have been thousands and thousands of have protest, but then the official figure is, 3,500 to 4,000. It's probably much higher than that. It is amazing that people still go out after Friday prayers and put their lives on the line. What's your understanding, though, Bassam Haddad, of the regime's confidence that it can stay on? I'm told by a former specialist on Iran from the National Security Council that in spite of our analysts saying that Turkey's the new power in the region and Iran is going to lose Syria, what's your understanding of why this regime appears to be confident, why the Iranians apparently are confident that they can win at the end of the day? They would seem, in a broad sense, to be on the wrong side of history.
They are on the wrong side of history because of the violence that they've unleashed on the Syrian people for several decades now. And at this point, it's much less the question of them being confident. It's much more the question of them having no choices left. After having actually engaged in the kind of oppression that they have engaged in over the years, and after having a situation where after 8 months, they've actually killed more than 3,000 people directly, if you want to account for others that have, you know, been killed, in other words, soldiers or army officers that have been killed in the other direction, but at least 3,500 Syrian protesters were killed. After that situation, the regime is unable to make a sincere compromise that will be considered credible. So the regime is basically continuing with its zero-sum game approach, knowing that the only choice is fight until the end. Other options of compromise have always been considered, and some laws or stipulations were issued, but they were completely not credible. Even the agreements that the regime agreed to with the Arab League or otherwise, I mean, they violated them as they were actually signing those agreements. And of late, they violated the agreement to cease fire, so to speak. And last week, according to what the Arab League and Syria decided, and they continued with the same exact pattern. Now, one can speak of movements, or armed gangs, as the regime would like to say, and it's not untrue. It's not completely made up by the regime. But it's not like the regime is only targeting these armed gangs. They are actually targeting everyone. So that excuse, even if it's partially, it has some truth to it in the sense that parts of the opposition are armed or the defectors from the army are naturally armed, it doesn't explain why peaceful protesters are being killed in peaceful protests, and the camera shows this across the country.
Well, again, the frontline piece, which was very, very powerful, made it very clear that ordinary people are just terrorized, and young people are picked up in the middle of the night by these roaming gangs of security people who come in and trash the homes and take away the young men and beat up the parents and leave with signs on the building saying, "We love you, Bashar." And they also interviewed a number of Syrian army defectors still in their fatigues, but they weren't armed. So it's not clear to me, you may be able to escape from the army base, but I don't think you can escape with a weapon, can you? I mean, the Alawite officer corps and the security people have all the army locked down, don't they? I don't think they can defect with their weapons, can they?
No, I mean, look, they have control of anything at the middle and upper middle levels. But they cannot control the average soldier with his rifle, and that's been the majority of the cases of defections. There have been defections at higher levels, but they were extremely rare.
Where is the break going to come then, if it is to come? You have Turkey next door creating a kind of safe zone. In they even evacuated their diplomats a couple of days ago. They're taking a very strong stance. The Europeans are just increasing sanctions on Syria. Where is this regime vulnerable, and where is it likely to crack?
Economically. The problem that the regime will be facing in a few months, even if things continue for a few months, we're not talking 10 months, we're talking more like 5 or 6 months, is that the regime will ultimately end up being end up running out of funds, basically, to fund this campaign. And they will, of course, they are deprived of certain revenues, whether it's from oil or otherwise. So there will actually have to face a situation where the oppression of the protesters or the military campaign that they are leading will not be sustainable in the long run. And that will spark a debate internally at the highest levels that might end up in some sort of schism or some sort of compromise that, you know, the people will actually believe as a result of the kind of, you know, the kind of rarity that it would provide, because the regime will not actually come to terms unless it really, really must.
Well, just in closing, Bassam Haddad, the Arab League are going to discuss Syria again on Wednesday. Is there anything that they can do? Clearly, the Europeans in the West are staying out of this. Is there anything that can be done on a regional basis?
I do not feel that this is the right time right now to do that. I do not feel that the Syrian regime feels that it's the right time to do this, especially after this decision by the Arab League. I think that regional intervention might be more effective a bit more down the line. Unfortunately, not today, not at this point.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Bassam Haddad.
Thank you for talking to me.
Again, I've been speaking with Bassam Haddad, who's the director of the Middle East Studies Program at George Mason University. He's also a visiting professor at Georgetown University and serves as a founding editor of the Arab Studies Journal. His latest book on Syrian political economy is The Political Economy of Regime Security, State Business Networks in Syria. He also serves on the editorial committee of Middle East Report. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how the GOP became the party of the rich. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining me now is Tim Dickinson, who is the National Affairs Correspondent at Rolling Stone magazine and blogs at Rolling Stone. He has a special article in the current issue of Rolling Stone, How the GOP Became the Party of the Rich. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tim Dickinson. And the article really is a very lengthy examination of this evolution of the party of Lincoln into the party of the Koch brothers. And the party of the 1%, how do they get away with it? I mean, they're only, if you're talking about the 1%, if we had a real democracy, there'd be no way in the world that a party that represents only 1% of the people could ever get elected.
As some academics, Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson, describe it in their book, Winner Take All Politics, the GOP is very good at serving up what they call horse and rabbit stew. So there are certain little sweeteners in there that, you know, the child tax credit and various other, you know, some, gestures which are meaningful in people's lives, but pale in comparison. There's turned out to be dimes on the dollar or pennies on the dollar, really, for the kinds of benefits that are going to the very top. And so the GOP has been sort of very adroit at providing, you know, marginal benefits for people who are really desperate for them, while, you know, larding the very top of the income spectrum with very special tax favors.
You quote here David Stockman, who, of course, we remember from the Reagan days when he went behind the woodshed for telling the truth, that the Republican Party has totally abdicated its job in our democracy. Then he goes on to say they're on this anti-tax jihad, one that benefits the prosperous class. Then he also refers to Grover Norquist as a anti-tax terrorist. I mean, why is it that this fellow, Grover Norquist, has unprecedented power?
Well, starting in about 1995, when Reagan was pushing through the last major overhaul of the tax code, Grover Norquist and Americans, I'm forgetting the name of his group momentarily. I'm having a Rick Perry moment. But anyhow, his anti-tax group was set up to prevent backsliding on the reforms of the 1986 bill and to push it forward over the finish line. And so Grover Norquist has had since then this anti-tax pledge, which is generally understood as just having just being against taxes, but it also prohibits GOP politicians, people who sign it, from closing any tax loopholes to pay for anything except for new tax cuts. And this made a modicum of sense following the cleaning up of the tax code. You know, there weren't very many loopholes, and new rates had been set, and it sort of made sense in a certain degree to say, you know, we're the GOP, and we're going to protect our accomplishment here. But it's become, in many respects, just a very vicious tool for protecting what have become tax favors built into the tax code over the last few decades. And so that now you have, yacht owners deducting the interest on their, you know, any boat large enough to have a bathroom, and, you know, millionaires with luxury homes who get to deduct that from their taxes. And yet when, you know, the GOP is running around saying America is broke and we need to, you know, cut the benefits of people who need support, you know, heating their homes in the winter, and, you know, child nutrition funding, and all that is on the chopping block, but because of this pledge, no one can touch, these obvious distortions of the tax code that benefit super wealthy, unless that somehow goes to lowering somebody else's tax rate. It's sort of preposterous. And honest Republicans, people like Alan Simpson, have said as much.
It's still a mystery, Tim Dickinson, how this obscure lobbyist, by the way, he's both a lobbyist and a head of Americans for Tax Reform. He's sort of the den mother for all of these young conservative activists. He has a salon that apparently is the hot ticket amongst the aspiring right-wing activists. He's been described as Liberace with a wife. I mean, the New York Times has been writing up editorials recently about how his power is being diminished, and how a few brave Republicans are stepping up and renouncing the pledge. But it feels like, you know, McCarthy and J. Edgar Hoover.
Well, I mean, the crux of Norquist's power, there's sort of two different things. He holds this Wednesday salon, this Wednesday meeting that sort of convenes the grassroots activist segments of the GOP and puts them in contact with policymakers and lobbyists, and they try and sort of set GOP policies. So he stands astride of this meeting of the establishment and the grassroots, and that gives him sort of tremendous power, because the single issue that is the glue to all that is this anti-tax policy. And so if you mess with Grover Norquist, you're essentially messing with the vast right-wing conspiracy, that there are a lot of people who can punish you, and if you go back on this tax pledge, you're going to get primaried, and that primary opponent's going to be very well funded. And so everyone in the GOP, I think, understands that. I mean, we're at one of these moments now with the Super Committee where push is coming to shove, and people are starting to question whether they need to put the country ahead of this pledge. And I think it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. But I don't think for the murmurs that you're hearing about some discontent with the pledge, that you're actually seeing people who are sticking their necks out and saying, you know, I will vote for raising revenue.
Well, clearly what happened to George H.W. Bush, read my lips, no new taxes, and when he was forced to deal with reality and raise taxes, he lost the election to Clinton, as we all know. Conservatives took that as a lesson. It may not be an accurate one, because there was this fellow Ross Perot who split the vote in took 20 million votes, arguably, away from the Republicans. But nevertheless, that has been, I take it, that's what's been keeping them in line in terms of sticking with Norquist's pledge.
Right. I mean, it's sort of a self-serving narrative on Norquist's part, but certainly he says, you know, that was sort of the pivotal moment. He distinguished himself from Bob Dole and won the nomination in 1988 by signing the pledge, and then made it the centerpiece of his general election campaign against Dukakis. And then when he reversed himself and raised taxes, that certainly in the Norquist narrative created the running room for a candidate like Ross Perot to stand up and say, I'm something different. You know, you can trust me, you can't trust him. But I think that really is sort of where the pledge went from, you know, Norquist himself likens it to bottling, I'll respect you in the morning. You know, this is one of the great, most frequently broken pledges in politics, I won't raise your taxes, and suddenly it's become sort of a blood oath, and it's something that you break only if you're prepared to sacrifice your office. And I think the other thing to understand, too, is that Norquist has taken sort of a minor league baseball approach to all of this, where he has taken the pledge to state legislatures and politicians like Eric Cantor, who come up through this, you know, state houses, in Cantor's case, he signed this pledge when he was a member of the Virginia House of Delegates, and now has come to Washington and leads, you know, all these Tea Party freshmen, who many of whom did the same thing. So this is now sort of core to the Republican brand, as it were.
Well, you mentioned Tim Dickinson again. Tim Dickinson is the national affairs correspondent at Rolling Stone magazine. He blogs at rollingstone.com, and he has a special report in the current issue of Rolling Stone, how the GOP became the party of the rich. You mentioned the super committee. There are increasing reports that indicate that it may be deadlocked. And, of course, if it's deadlocked, then these mandatory cuts come in. So you'd think there's an incentive for them to pass something out of the committee. But the reason it's deadlocked, I'm told, is because the Republicans will not budge on tax breaks for the rich. I mean, again, this is a line in the sand that they've drawn, and it just, I find it astounding that the American people put up with it, unless, you know, we're all hopelessly in the thrall of millionaires and billionaires, and, you know, we are so conditioned to believe that we're all going to win the lottery. I just don't believe that is the way the American people are.
You know, it's perplexing, and I don't think that most people sort of understand the extent to which there are opportunities to raise revenue without raising taxes, and so that if you close some of these tax favors, these things that are sort of off the table because of the second part of Norquist's pledge, some of these things are bread and butter, you know, the mortgage interest deduction, but some of them are just simple accounting rules for oil companies and others that just create these absurd market distorting pressures that in normal times, in sort of a normal conversation, conservatives worried about fiscal discipline and about free markets would be very much against. Just to give you understanding, this, if you take all the favoritism, all the different ways that money is dispersed or not collected essentially through the tax code, that amount of revenue is actually greater than the amount of revenue that's collected from income taxes. So this is, we're talking about $1.2 trillion a year that Treasury forgoes because of special tax favors. And so there's more than enough money there to go after, you know, to solve this entire phony debt crisis. I mean, we have a real problem with our debt, but we're not broke. There's a chance, tremendous opportunities to raise revenue in ways that probably correct distortions in the market and might you know, have our economy working better afterward. And so this is a crisis that has been essentially foisted on the American public by the Republican Party. And the obvious solution of closing some of these tax loopholes has been put off the table because of this pledge that, you know, some Republicans, former Republicans like George Voinovich, say is a, you know, violation of a politician's oath of office. That if you sign this pledge, you're putting that before your loyalty and adherence to the Constitution and your constituencies.
Well, Tim Dickinson, as your article points out in the current issue of Rolling Stone, how the GOP became the party of the rich, in the last few decades, the annual income of the 400 richest Americans has more than tripled, while their share of the tax burden has plunged by 40%. And if you go back to Eisenhower, the richest Americans were taxed at 92%. Then under Kennedy, it would drop down to 70%. Under Reagan, it dropped down to 50%. And under George W. Bush, it dropped down to what, about 30%?
35%,
right.
The traditional narrative sort of takes this, at 1979, 1980, and the tax revolt that Reagan led and the Trojan horse that led to an across the board cut in marginal tax rates. And I think that's certainly that's true. And I think what my article tries to tease out, though, is that there's some subtlety that misses, and that, when Reagan pushed through that tax cut, there was this hope that there would also be, spending cuts along with that, that the budget would remain largely in balance, and that the sort of voodoo economics would create a lot of growth, and that would keep the budget situation from getting out of hand. And almost immediately after they passed that tax cut, deficits, the spending cuts didn't materialize. Deficits started to spike out of control, and it was Bob Dole, fellow Republican, who led the effort to increase taxes in 1982. And for the rest of his term, Reagan was quite a tax increaser in sort of the traditional Republican mold of let's keep our books in balance. And Reagan actually raised taxes on capital gains as part of his tax reform so that they were in line with his lowered marginal tax rates. But what happened in 1997 is that Republicans, led by Newt Gingrich, decoupled that again. And so they took capital gains from 28% down to just 20%. And that just gives a huge huge benefit to the investor class. And this, we're talking about, I think, about two-thirds of that benefit went directly to the 1%. And from there on, Bush had an across-the-board tax cut, but then in 2003 lowered the capital gains rate again to 15%. And so there's some underlying factors that have led to income inequality in this country, but the tax policy has worked to exacerbate that. So that at the very time that the richest Americans are getting richer, the tax policy is working to help them get richer still. And it seems clear that that's a return on investment from these rich people investing in Washington.
Well, Tim Dickinson, you quote Bruce Bartlett, the architect of Reagan's 1981 tax cut, in your article, saying that taxes are ridiculously low, which anybody that's ever been in any other country on the planet knows that the U.S. has got the lowest taxes of all. In Europe, they have VAT taxes, et cetera, along with steep income taxes, and pretty much every other social democracy has considerably greater taxes. But of course, you do get government services in return. When you have the Michelle Bachmanns of the world in the debates talking about how people shouldn't, if they don't work, they shouldn't be fed. She's on this jihad against food stamps. She's also all the time talking about how we're taxed. I think the American people actually believe it. I know if anybody reads your article, they get disabused of it. But what do you think the impasse there is in terms of educating the American people to recognize how little comparatively they're taxed?
The problem truly is, I think, that we're not taxing our elites. We don't sort of have this political system that is competent enough to tax people at the top. I mean, you could make the argument that taxes should be higher overall, but the fact that people who are the top 400 income earners are paying an effective tax rate that's 5% lower than a single average worker is just outlandish on its face. And so, at the same time that Michelle Bachmann is saying that everyone in the country should have to pay something in tax, and it used to be a Republican talking point that it was a good thing that, Ronald Reagan and others had helped free people at the low income levels from the burden of the federal income taxes. That used to be something that Republicans celebrated. Now they target the whatever percent they say don't pay any income tax. But at the same time that Michelle Bachmann is saying that, she wants to do away with capital gains taxes, which would sort of have the perverse effect of kicking, I think it's something like 25,000 millionaires off the tax rolls entirely. It's people who like Mitt Romney, make money from money. And so in this, and you know, this is a Tea Party darling, you know, so there's a real disconnect here that a woman who holds herself out as a champion of you know, the little guys, in fact, advocating a tax policy that would let tens of thousands of millionaires pay no tax and then pay no tax again when that income is passed on to the heirs.
You also quote David K. Johnston, who's, I think, one of the leading experts on taxes, and particularly how the social engineering aspect of taxes and how deeply they affect the nation and how it evolves. And I think it's pretty clear that the rich have gotten away with an extraordinary robbery, if you will, this Robin Hood in reverse trend that's been going on for so long. And that's what leaves you sort of scratching your head, trying to figure out, one, how they've gotten away with it. And does it come down to the fact, Tim Dickinson, that money has transcended votes in our electoral system? Because if you create a political system that's based on money and the person with the most money wins, then that would suggest that the richest people will end up owning the system.
Well, I mean, the way that Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, put it to me is that, you know, rich people now get a better return from investing in Washington than they do from investing in new products or new factories or R&D or the rest of it. And so if you can make money with money and the best return on investment that you can get is lobbying politicians in Washington to lower your tax rate, well, there's sort of a rational incentive to do that. And I think, you know, I think that that's the danger of that is only accelerated in this post-Citizens United world where the cap on donations is gone now. You know, and you have, you know, and you have, problematically, you have people like Chuck Schumer in the Democratic Party who are, you know, ably defending the interests of their money constituents. And so there's spillover here. There are, you know, sort of key Democratic enablers who contribute to this trend that I've been writing about here. But certainly the impetus. You know, you look at where we are. You have people on the streets who are decrying income inequality, and you have politicians from Herman Cain to Rick Perry to Newt Gingrich who are proposing a flat tax, which essentially would raise taxes on the poor and the middle class to pay for massive new tax cuts for the top 1% for millionaires. And so it's just a strange world we live in where, you know, especially these people are standing as somehow defenders of the little guy against you know, the abuses of the system.
Well, we started out the program today, Tim Dickinson, talking about the 60 Minutes report on how the Congress has created a unique privilege unto themselves that exempts them from insider trading. And that this is quite pervasive, that, you know, members of Congress who get special information about how a bill is going to be passed and what's in the bill and who will win and who will lose from the bill are able to short the market and do insider trading that would put any ordinary person in jail or even a Wall Street banker in jail. And that suggests to me, in the context of what we're talking about, is that, you know, that maybe the billionaires, they're total whores and hirelings of the billionaires. And this is this is some crumbs under the table for them.
I confess to not having seen the 60 Minutes program, but although I've been reading bits and pieces about it. But it, I think that we have a pervasively rotten system, and I think Americans are waking up to that. And I think you'll see that in the, you know, the record low approval ratings of Congress and the rest of it. And so, you know, we need some fundamental reforms to protect the interests of the 99%.
Well, just in closing, Tim Dickinson, it's still very puzzling for me to try and figure out how this has happened and how this has happened so inexorably. And that's what your article in the current issue of Rolling Stone, How the GOP Became the Party of the Rich, it's a lengthy treatise on the history of how we've come to be where we are. But essentially, I guess it's about how our democracy has sort of transgressed into a kind of oligarchy, and our economy has become a plutonomy. And the question you keep asking yourself is, well, you know, this is so at odds with the mythology of an egalitarian society, a meritocracy. Americans see themselves as the American dream, which is anchored in the middle class. And yet that is a cruel joke in today's context. Just two questions that come out of that. One is, why would anybody want to destroy the middle class? And two, what do you think will happen? What do you think will wake up the middle class and return America to its mythology that has been so disgraced?
Well, I mean, if you look at sort of the intellectual arguments of the people who are leading this charge, the Grover Norquist of the world, they see progressive taxation as a form of theft, and sort of embrace radical notions of Ayn Rand and others, that greed is fundamentally moral, and that people acting in their self-interest should be rewarded to whatever degree is feasible. And so that, I confronted Grover Norquist on this precisely. I said, do you have any moral qualms about, what you're doing? That people who need government services are robbed of them, and people who, don't want for anything in the world are lavished with these favors. And he said, I understand, greed, and I understand, envy, but, essentially progressive taxation has no moral component, that it's simply a form of theft. That's sort of the radical ideology that underlies all of this. And I'm sorry, I've lost track of your question.
Well, the second question is, do you think there's a way for people to sort of wake up and want to restore, want to bring the mythology into line with the reality? In other words, I wake up, basically say, the middle class is endangered. Can we bring back America?
I think if you look for what unites the Tea Party and the Occupy movement, both of them seem to be populated by people who have, worked hard and played by the rules and found themselves not getting ahead. And I think you see a lot of anger that isn't sort of necessarily well directed, but I think you both on the right and the left, you see members of the middle class standing up, being outraged and saying this system isn't working for us. And I think if you can, if there is a moment of awakening that the interests of both of those disparate movements are not, oppositional, but in fact lead to some of the same conclusions about needing to reform the system so that it works on behalf of the little guy again, I think that then you will have some real opportunities for change, because I think even a political system that's as captured as ours needs to be responsive to the electorate. And if the electorate really starts to get it, then I think some of these practices, some of this policy that favors the 1% so grotesquely is in danger.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Tim Dickinson.
I appreciate your interest. Thank you.
And I've been speaking with Tim Dickinson, who is the Rolling Stone reporter responsible for the article, How the GOP Became the Party of the Rich. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank Graham Fitzgibbon, the producer. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Took the kids to the park and disappeared.